HD Smartcast. You are listening to an HD Smartcast original.
Hi, I am Tenzin, and well, I am so many things. An entrepreneur, a public speaker, translation compeer, and a lifestyle writer. But at my very core, I am a Tibetan. But if you ask me what Tibet, its people, and the culture is like, then I must honestly say that I have never been to Tibet. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. If you've never been to Tibet either, then this podcast is for you. Hello and Tasha Delay. I have a question for you and I'd love for you to answer this. Why are you listening to me right now? Why are you here? It's simple. You like the show. You like the content. And in some way, I believe I am influencing you with this content, right? You see, we're all influenced by some kind of content, whether it is through our social media, whether it is through our television, cinema, it could be anything. The source could be anything. Our personalities, our perspectives are influenced by the kind of content that we consume. Today, we're discussing cinema and more specifically on how, cinema or films can help us understand the Tibetan culture, our narrative, and our life as refugees in exile. We have with us today Tenzing Sonam, an award-winning Tibetan film director who is amplifying our narrative and our culture through his films. He is a writer, essayist, also the co-founder of White Crane Films.
Welcome to CTT. I am so excited to have you on. I've been eagerly looking forward to having this conversation with you. And to be very honest, Tenzing La, I've been pondering upon how I should go about introducing you because there's so much that you've done and are doing. But for now, I am really eager to know about your journey and how did you get into filmmaking?
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me to your show. I'm very happy to be here. When I first started out, I actually wanted to be a writer. I was more interested in writing. And then I got into the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, where I wanted to kind of pursue my ambition to be a writer. But when I got to Berkeley, what I discovered was art house cinema. Berkeley was full of like little cinema halls, like art house cinema halls, and you could watch all the great classics from around the world and all the kind of, contemporary independent films. And that really sparked my love for cinema. At the same time, in Berkeley, they had a broadcast journalism department in the school. And I kind of gravitated towards the broadcast journalism department and ended up making a documentary as my thesis project. And I guess that's how it all started. You know, that was the beginning of the journey.
Okay. You know, sometimes even our plan doesn't even have a plan, you know? What you plan to do when you sometimes, if you're destined to do something else, then you do it anyway. So I think it's good that you took that route because then the world has such great films.
Well, it was, the right choice I made, you know, because in a sense, that's all I've done pretty much ever since my student days in Berkeley.
Absolutely. And along with your wife, Ritu, right? You've made over 20 documentaries. You have worldwide installations, two dramatic features. A recurring subject in your work has been the issue of Tibet, the nationality, the identity crisis, the issues that surround the exiled Tibetan community in India. And I know that you and Ritu both have been vested in this, both personally and artistically. What is the kind of impact do you want your films to make? Because after watching the films, what do you want your audiences to do? Do you want them to participate in our cause? Do you want them to know what's happening? What's the real case that's happening in our community and the issues that surround us? What do you want them to do?
Yeah, so very early on in you know, our kind of career as filmmakers, we realized that although there were already films about Tibet, they were mostly films made by outsiders, you know. And although they were kind of well-meaning and pretty much sympathetic to the Tibetan cause, to Tibetan culture, they always had an outsider's perspective. And we felt it was really important that Tibetans tell their own stories. And especially like me being a Tibetan, having grown up in exile, I felt that I needed to somehow give voice to our experience, you know. And so that was the main kind of one of the early realizations we had. And we wanted to fill that gap, that vacuum, that so Tibetans can tell their own stories through film, you know, which, of course, at the time was not easy because firstly, you know, being in exile, we don't have that option to start making films, right?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, we don't have a tradition of filmmaking in Tibet that we can look back on and, you know, sort of take inspiration from. So in a sense, one had to start from scratch almost, you know. So one of the things that was very important to us was to try and reflect what was happening inside Tibet, but also the exile kind of experience in an honest and, you know, kind of, you know, human way, in a universal way. And I think that's what we set out to do. We just wanted to expose and tell our stories to a larger audience. Of course, that's not an easy thing to do because, you know, making films is an expensive affair. And getting funding to make films, I mean, we don't have, you know, the exiled Tibetan community can't support filmmaking like that. We are a tiny kind of, you know, community, so we don't even have a proper audience in a sense.
True, right? Absolutely, so, yes.
Yeah. So we had to look for funding from, you know, Western, mostly Western kind of sources, broadcasters, you know, individuals, things like that. And the problem with that always is that, like, say, if you're making a film for the BBC, then you have to conform to somehow to what they want, right? It has to fit into their kind of
template. Yes.
Their template. So in that sense, in the early days, we didn't have the full freedom to really tell the stories like we wanted to. But at the same time, I think, you know, we are quite proud of the films we made in the early days. And I think they reached out to a lot of audiences, you know, worldwide, you know, because they were on the BBC, they were on PBS in America. They had theatrical releases in America and in Europe. So, you know, we were able to reach a wider audience. And I think that's something that I feel very proud about, yeah. And in terms of what do we want our audiences to take away from our films, I think just, you know, to understand that we Tibetans are no different from any other people. We're not kind of, you know, because either the West sort of, and I'm saying the West, but it's also like other outside kind of, you know, communities, sees Tibet in very kind of black and white terms. Like it's either a Buddhist, peaceful, you know, compassionate group of people. And, you know, so we have to, you know, sort of like, you know, raise them on a kind of a pedestal almost. But that misses the reality of our situation, right? We are political exiles. We are, you know, our country is undergoing, you know, severe kind of, you know, problems under the Chinese occupation. And that's something that needs to be told on our terms. So I guess we wanted our audiences to come away with a more maybe nuanced understanding of what Tibet is, who Tibetans are, what kind of problems we face, you know, just to kind of try and shed light on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of Dreaming Lhasa, it was the first of its kind Tibetan feature film to explore the life of Tibetan refugees in India, right? And you touch upon topics like the issues that we face, whether it is in terms of our identity. It's like when you don't have a country, you're stateless. I mean, that's what I write. So that's what most of the Tibetan refugees write when you talk about your nationality, stateless. That's the option in the category. And it's like you want to belong, but you don't want to belong. And you're in this really weird place. Also, I feel personally that as we approach to a new era, right, I'm beginning to feel that, you know, a lot of people say, you know, our culture is diluting. The younger generation is moving towards the Western culture and also is mesmerized, people staying in India, by Bollywood and the Indian culture. I think it's okay to embrace that. What do you have to say about that? I think the film also portrays a little aspect of that, isn't it? And it mirrors, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, for a very long time, Ritu and I wanted to make a dramatic feature film because, you know, until then we had only been making documentaries. But in a sense, as I mentioned earlier, we were both, you know, we loved cinema and we watched so many movies when we were students in the Bay Area in California. So we always had this idea of making a feature film, you know. And I started working on the script for Dreaming Lhasa many years before we actually got to make the film. And the idea really evolved out of a number of different things that were happening in exile at the time. So one was, you know, from the 90s onwards, a lot of Tibetans from Tibet suddenly started coming to India. And it was like a second wave of refugees that came into India. And they were very different from the earlier generation, the ones who had come in, you know, 1959 and in the early 60s. And they were very different from people like you or me who had grown up in exile, right? Because they were, you know, they had grown up under Chinese occupation. They had come from Tibet. They had connections, you know, direct connections with their homeland. They spoke different dialects, you know. And in a sense, there was this tension between the older kind of community and these new refugees, a little bit of a tension in the sense that I guess, you know, we couldn't figure out, you know, where each, you know, each of us was coming from. And, you know, we had this term for them, Sanjawas, right? The newcomers, right. You know, which is kind of almost derogatory.
Exactly.
So, so there was that phenomenon happening. At the same time, there was a whole generation of younger Tibetans who had, you know, grown up in India, born and brought up, had never seen Tibet, still felt very Tibetan, but in a sense kind of found it difficult to find ways of expressing, you know, their identity. And, you know, so in the film you have, you know, the young person in Dharamsala, you know, who kind of is very typical of a certain generation of youngsters who grew up in Dharamsala, who were influenced by, you know, the West, got into, you know, Western music and started hanging out with, you know, Western travelers. And somehow, you know, that was their kind of world, you know, a bit confused as well. You know. And then you had a whole different kind of Tibetan who was, you know, brought up in the West, who often couldn't speak Tibetan even, but still felt very Tibetan. And I guess when we made Dreaming Lhasa, that was kind of just the start. But today, like, you know, almost 20 years later, that's really becoming even more kind of noticeable, right? You know, a whole generation of young Tibetans from the West who want to come back to Dharamsala to find their roots and their identity. So I guess the story was somehow trying to tell these different layers, like, you know, the Tibetans from Tibet, the Tibetans who grew up in India, the Tibetans who grew up in the West, and reflecting on, you know, the question of who is a Tibetan really? What does it mean to be Tibetan? You know, is the Tibetan who comes from Tibet somehow more genuine and more Tibetan than us who, you know, grew up in exile? You know, so because, you know, these are questions that confront us. And we felt that through a fictionalized, you know, dramatic sort of feature film, one could explore these questions. And so that was the attempt.
Okay. And was it inspired by someone's real life? Because, I mean, it's something that's so relatable, right? So was it inspired by someone else's real life?
Not, no, it wasn't inspired by any one kind of person's story or any one incident as such. But of course, they were kind of composite characters, you know, that were built on people that we knew, you know, like we knew all these young people in Dharamsala at the time, you know, we were very, you know, close to them. So we knew what they were going through. And so, yeah, it wasn't kind of based on any one story as such. It was fictionalized in that sense.
Okay. Okay. Because, I mean, as filmmakers, you have to be really observant. I think when you are good at observation, then you can create great cinema. Even actors, for that matter, they say sometimes you just don't have to act. You just be someone else, right? You look at the vendor down your street and just look at how he is. I mean, there you have a character for a film. So in that way, I think observation does play a part. In one of your interviews, you mentioned that most of the actors in the film were non-professionals. Were they non-professional? Like, did you cast non-professionals for a reason so that you keep sort of like a natural feel to the movie, to the film?
No, actually, the answer is very simple. You know, there are no professional Tibetan actors in the exile community, right?
Right.
At that time in 2000.
Yes.
Well, we shot the film in 2003, so there were just almost no Tibetans who had any kind of acting experience in films. So we had no choice. We had to look for, you know, non-professionals. And we did a big casting call. We, you know, really looked for all the different characters. It was, you know, quite a challenge. But only Champa Kesang, who is the person who plays the guy who comes from Tibet, he was the only one who had some acting experience prior to that. You know, he had acted in some bigger movies. So he was the only one who one could say, and even then, he's not a professional actor, you know. he works, he does other things, right?
Okay.
But he had experience. So yeah, we just, you know, had to, we had no choice. We had to find non-professional actors. And I guess what made the process easier was that they could relate to the characters, you know, because these characters were like people like themselves. So, you know, the person who comes from America, she is like that in real life, you know. You know, she was looking for her kind of roots. She couldn't speak Tibetan too well. The person in Dharamsala is like that, you know. So I think that helped, that all the roles were kind of, you know, relatable. So the acting part was much easier. Although we did have an acting workshop and, you know, everything. So we did prepare the actors, we trained them. And, you know, that hasn't changed because we made our second feature film, The Sweet Requiem, which we shot in 2017. And most of the actors in The Sweet Requiem are also non-professionals. I mean, the lead character in the film is, you know, a young woman who has never acted before in her life. So in that sense, you know, we're still kind of in that place. Although today there are more Tibetans who have had acting experience. And I think we have some professional Tibetan actors now. So in that sense, things are slightly different. But yeah, but by and large, it's still, you know, pretty much difficult to find Tibetan actors.
Okay, so I think it's good because in that way, at least we get to see sort of like a non-acting actor. You see the person who's just doing what a normal Tibetan would do.
Right.
So that's right. Wonderful. Please share with us your experience of shooting A Stranger in My Native Land. It is a film that entails your personal account of your visit, first ever visit to Tibet. And you came vis-a-vis with your long lost relatives. How is that like? I mean, I cannot even imagine how that must have been for you. What was the conversation that happened?
Yeah, so this was in 1995, and Ritu and I had the opportunity to go to Tibet. You know, as you said, I was born in India, so I'd never been to Tibet. That was my first visit there. Also, both my parents, most of their relatives got left behind in Tibet. Mm. So in exile, we had a very small family. You know, my father's brothers and sisters, his nephews and nieces were all back in Tibet. And the same with my mom, her brother, her sister, they all got left behind in Tibet. So we always knew that we had relatives, you know, in Tibet. But, you know, of course, for the longest time, there was no way of even communicating with them. But then in the 80s, when things opened up a bit, some of these relatives came to exile and, you know, we had a chance to meet them for the first time.
Yes.
Yes. So going back to Tibet, you know, for the first time was, you know, was both kind of, you know, deeply kind of joyful and, you know, it was almost like a dream, you know, to suddenly be back in the country that you've always heard about and thought about. But at the same time, it was also like very, very depressing to actually see, you know, the situation firsthand. We started our trip in Amdo, where my father comes from. And he comes from a part of Amdo that's right on the edge of the Tibetan plateau, you know, near Kumbum Monastery. And it's an area that had already been kind of taken over by Chinese settlers, you know, Muslim settlers, like generations before even the fall of Tibet. So there was already like, you know, many different cultures sort of at play there.
Right.
And people there pretty much spoke Siling dialect, you know, which is the dialect they speak in Siling. And no one spoke Tibetan, even the Tibetans. So
in Amdo.
In that part of Amdo, yes, near Kumbum. So this is the area where His Holiness also comes from. You know?
Yes, so, he was found there, isn't it? He was,
there, yes.
Yeah.
So it's that whole belt, basically, the Tibetans there pretty much have lost their language and they speak, you know, the local Chinese dialect. I knew this because my father used to speak Siling dialect when, you know, when he was in India, and he used to speak Siling dialect with other people who came from Siling, and it was a kind of a special code language they had, you know, which was, you know, no one else could understand what they were saying, right? But then suddenly going to his village, meeting my nephew, actually my first cousins, a lot of my first cousins, and not being able to speak to them at all. I mean, that was like really you know, the first shock, you know, that you really realized, oh my God, this is Tibet. Like, this is actually like my home, you know, and I can't even, you know, I'm like completely a stranger here, right? So luckily, one of my cousins had come to India before and he could speak Lhasa dialect. So he was our main kind of interpreter and translator. And if he hadn't been there, I think, you know, it would have been really sad. In fact, I was so depressed that I said to Ritu, like, let's leave, you know, this is like, I can't take this. But then we got used to it. We stayed in Kumbh Monastery and then eventually made our way to Lhasa, where my mother's relatives are. Coming into Lhasa was felt more comfortable because suddenly everyone was speaking, you know, Lhasa Khe, and I could understand everything. And it was a bit more like what I had imagined Tibet to be, you know, growing up. Yeah. But it also then made you realize that Tibet's really huge. And there are all these different provinces. They speak different dialects, different languages. Not languages, but different dialects. And in exile, we grew up with this idea that, you know, we all spoke Lhasa Khe, right? And that was kind of Tibet. So, but it was really emotional and you know, we'd taken a camera with us, but often, you know, the idea of even filming something was so far from our minds because just experiencing, you know, that, you know, meeting your family for the first time, seeing their homes for the first time was so overwhelming that, you know, the thought of filming it just didn't even, you know, was difficult. Also, we had to be very careful about what we recorded and filmed, because we just didn't want to, you know, get them into trouble in any way in case, you know, we got stopped by the Chinese and they kind of took our videotapes and, you know, saw what was happening. So that also limited how we could kind of structure a film. We had to leave out so many things, you know, so many conversations, so many kind of really, you know, deep kind of conversations that we had. We just couldn't include them in the film. So we just had to be so careful. So when we came out of Tibet, we weren't even sure if we had enough material to actually make a film because the whole experience had been so almost like a dream, like I said. And we had filmed some things. We hadn't filmed other things. We didn't know what we had, you know. So eventually we kind of were able to put a film together. And I'm really happy that I did, because most of those relatives, like the older ones, have all passed away now. And it's, you know, looking at that film and that footage always reminds us of what it was like, you know, because otherwise it's so easy to forget, right? You know, so it's a good record of our trip. And I'm really glad we did that, because we haven't been able to go back since. So, yeah.
Well, I'm happy that you at least got to see our homeland. I mean, that's a fortune, because a lot of us, I mean, for me as well, the closest I've seen Tibet is from a border from Sikkim, you know.
Right.
So that's like, oh, that's my homeland. So that's, oh, that's all. Like, so it's amazing that you've at least seen Tibet, been to Tibet, and experienced what it is like, even though it was not like that before, you know, whatever happened with the whole Chinese occupation of Tibet in 1959. I can totally imagine, you know, being able to go to your homeland and looking at your relatives not being able to communicate with you, not being able to express what you feel. And I'm glad that you documented it. I'm glad that you have a recording of it so that at least people can see what it's like. And as you said, because of the regulations and because of the Chinese, it's hard to, you know, reveal all the documentations, all the recordings. Yeah. But whatever selective recordings you do have, I think that is very, very helpful for a lot of people. Please tell us a little bit about your installations worldwide. Which installation are you the most proud of?
So, one of the things we kind of started doing in the last maybe 10 years or so is working on video installations, even multimedia installations that would be shown in a gallery context or a museum context. Because what we realized is that that's a whole nother way of telling your story. It reaches a whole different kind of an audience, because it's in the kind of the art world, right? And so we thought it was important to, A, to kind of try and reach out to that audience, but B, also to explore this new medium, you know, this new way of trying to construct the story and tell something that's important to you. So we started out with single channel videos, which basically are like small documentaries, but they show on they show in a gallery. And so we did one on Tibetan Buddhist debate, which we filmed in Mungod in South India. And that video actually did quite well. It showed in a lot of different, you know, countries and different art spaces. But more recently, we did a big exhibition on self-immolations called Burning Against the Dying of the Light. And this was something that we felt we had to do, because it was at the height of the whole self-immolation kind of movement in Tibet, you know. And I'm sure you remember also, almost every day we were getting news of yet another person self-immolated. Videos were coming out, like horrific videos. And it was just so terrible and so tragic what was happening. And let's not forget, it's still going on, because we know that a young Tibetan singer just self-immolated the other day. But so we felt we had to respond to that in some way. And there was, you know, a lot of debate and discussion about whether self-immolation was the right way of protesting, whether it was a Buddhist thing to do, or whether it was like, you know, going against the principles of Buddhism. I mean, there are all these questions, right? So we put together this show, which used a lot of the video footage that came out of Tibet, but also used interviews with, ex-political prisoners from Tibet, tried to frame the whole kind of self-immolation kind of movement within a larger context so that one could understand it better. And so that show, the first exhibition was at Code Studios in Delhi, and then it showed again in Belgium at a biennial there. So that's something I think we're, you know, very happy that we did. But unfortunately, because it's so kind of horrific and immediate, a lot of people don't want to see that kind of, they don't want to, kind of face that kind of, imagery. So it's been difficult to get it shown in more places. And another exhibition we did after that was an archive-based installation, where I was going back, well, Ritu and me, we went back to my father's archives because, my father was very involved in the whole Tibetan resistance movement.
Yes.
Its involvement with the CIA. And throughout his time working on this, on the resistance, he had kept detailed records, documents, maps, and like literally thousands of photographs that he had saved. Mm-hmm. So when he passed away in 1999, his archives came to us. And we had also made a documentary on, the CIA and its involvement in the resistance, called The Shadow Circus. So we had also collected a lot of material. We had filmed interviews with a lot of former Tibetan freedom fighters, with former CIA officers who had trained the Tibetans. So we had all that material ourselves. So somehow we wanted to present that in a context where, a viewer could come and see all the different aspects of what had been going on with this struggle. So it was a show called Shadow Circus. It showed in Berlin as part of the Berlin National Film Festival. They have a sidebar called Forum Expanded. So it showed in a gallery in Berlin. And in fact, it's going to show next month at the IIC in Delhi. So we're actually preparing that show.
Okay. And,
that's something that's very exciting for us because it not only, pays homage to my father and his work and his sacrifice and uses all that material he kind of so diligently kind of gathered and saved, but it also tells a story that a lot of people don't know about, right? Including Tibetans, don't know the details of what that resistance struggle was all about. So it's something, we're very happy that we've done, and we're very happy that it's going to show in Delhi now.
Touché. You know, I was just going to ask you this question about, your father being a part of this resistance movement, being the main administrator for the Mustang Resistance Force and the mastermind behind numerous, undercover operations inside Tibet, right? So how does it make you feel? I mean, as a child, what was your, what did you think about what your father was doing in terms of his contribution to the Tibetan cause?
So, when I was growing up, me and my sisters, we had no idea at all what, Pala was doing. He used to, a lot of people used to come and meet him. He had a small office in our home. Mm. And so in the early days, lots of people would be coming, going, and he would just often disappear for days, sometimes for months,
Okay.
And my mother would just say he's gone. He works for Pershung, the Tibetan government. And
okay.
He's gone to Dharamsala for work, and he'll be back soon. So we never questioned that. We just assumed that that's what he was doing.
Correct.
It was only when I was 15 years old in 1974 that actually I was in a boarding school in Darjeeling. and we used to have a notice board where the day's newspaper would be pinned up, you know.
Right.
So one day I came and I was reading the news, and there was this little article that said something like, Kampa rebels in Nepal, arrested, and Kampa leaders, including Lhamul Tsering, you know. And, you know, my father's name is very unusual for a man, because Lhamul Tsering is usually a woman's name, right?
Yes.
But Lhamul in Amdo, in our part of Amdo, is very common for men to have as well. So I was thinking, Lhamul Tsering, that's my dad's name. But what's this about, you know, rebels in Nepal and being arrested and all of that? So my mother came to visit me soon after that. Mm. And then she told me, like, you know, yes, it's true. He's been arrested. He's in, a jail in Pokhara. But don't feel sad, because, you know, he was... Then she explained what he had been doing and why he was, why he had been arrested. So that was the first time I had an inkling of the kind of work he was doing. So after that, then I went to visit him in Kathmandu, and he was in prison for almost 7 years in Kathmandu, along with six other, guerrilla leaders, Mustang leaders. So I used to go during my holidays, meet him, and kind of got to know my father all over again, because I realized I actually didn't know him at all, you know.
He was
See, he was this mysterious kind of distant, almost distant figure who would be in and out of our home, and always like kind of caught up with work, and we were, you know, always told mustn't disturb him, you know. So, I didn't know him at all. It was only after, you know, meeting him in prison, and then when he came out of prison, that we really became close, and I really found out about, his life, where he came from, how he got involved. You know, all those things happened much later when I was an adult, actually.
Well, that must have been a surprise for you when your mother told you that, you know, he's doing this, he's part of the resistance movement, and it's been real. Because, you know, secret missions are like that. I mean, I've only seen this in movies. I've only watched this in movies happening. So this is a real life secret hero.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean... later on, of course, when I found out more details, he used to go to Calcutta like almost every month. That's where he used to disappear to a lot of the times, to meet up with his CIA counterpart in Calcutta to get briefing and to brief them. And the whole thing was like a real movie. You know, he would have to wait with a newspaper outside a certain lamppost. And then a car would come and, you know, pick him up, and he would get in the car to drive them to a safe house, like some apartment that they had rented just for this purpose. And then they'd kind of do their meetings and, you know, exchange documents, whatever. And then, you know, he'd have to come back. So, I mean, it was like that. It was really... kind of a cloak and dagger kind of, work that he was doing.
Wow. Okay. So movies are inspired by real life.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, sometimes real life is more bizarre than, even movies can be, right?
Hence proved. Yes. So storytelling has always been an integral part of our culture, whether it is in the form of our folklores, in form of our epics. We have epics like the King of Gesar, right? Gesar of Ling. Then we have our folklore about the Aztec monkey wandering in the mountains, seduced by goddess Tara disguised as a demon, right? The story of Ba Chigen Chanju Senpa, right? Would you ever be making films on topics like that, on epics and folklores of our country?
I would love to. And in fact, especially Gesar, the Gesar epic, I think would be amazing to be able to bring it to screen. But, you know, the problem is, of course, to make a film like that, you would need a lot of money. And, you'd have to recreate everything, right? And then, where would you film it? So it's kind of a dream. It's there in the back of my mind to do something like that, or maybe even something more simpler, like maybe a film on Agutomba, you know, like the rascal, you know, Tibetan, who's also considered to be a saint, actually, but he's a very naughty figure, who, you know, and there's many stories about him. Some of them are pretty obscene, actually.
Okay.
But it's something that, again, most people don't know, you know, and even the tradition of telling Agutomba stories in exile, you know, I don't think it's being done anymore. And I don't even know how many people are still alive who remember those stories. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But when we were kids, we used to be, you know, we used to hear a lot of these stories. So something like that could also be brought to screen. So yes, I would love to, but it depends. Financing is always a big hurdle.
Absolutely.
And we're also working on a number of, you know, projects at the moment. So kind of finding the time and all of that is also like
And then there is also, as you mentioned, Agutomba, I just recollected Songbul Norsang, right? The very famous tale of the businessman Norsang, right? I've heard that a lot. Is that also our folklore?
That's a Tibetan opera, right? That's Achila Mahua. So it's performed as an opera. It's kind of one of the most popular Tibetan operas.
Okay.
But yeah, that's again, I mean, you could say it's like folklore, absolutely.
Okay. Okay, because, you know, this is how the usual pattern is. When it's folk, usually it's transmitted orally, right? Orally, you whether you sing it, narrate it in the form of stories. That is what I've seen. Because as you mentioned, you would require more funding to make the Gesar of Ling happen. Because I mean, imagine if he has really amazing demigod capabilities, if he's flying in the air, you need VFX.
Well, you need to do something on the scale of Lord of the Rings, or you know, like,
exactly. Yeah,
it requires that kind of special effects and to make it really come alive. And
exactly.
It's amazing to do it, but I don't know, in exile I don't think we have the resources to do that. To get international funding, I think would be quite hard. But still, I mean, we can hope, right?
Absolutely.
And maybe there'll be some other younger Tibetan filmmakers who will take on the challenge and make it happen.
Well, we're hoping. Do you have any message for people tuning in to our show right now?
One of the things, I assume a lot of your audience is Indian, right? Is that
Indian, correct? We have people tuning in from India, from around the world, because this podcast is available globally. So people also tune in. A lot of Tibetans also tune in from USA, from Canada, from Europe, from everywhere around the world. So, yes.
Okay. I mean, I think the main message that, as a Tibetan that I always try and, kind of present is, firstly, not to forget what's happening in Tibet. It was a country that was illegally occupied by China. I mean, in many ways, it parallels what is happening right now in Ukraine, you know, with Russia kind of invading a peaceful, independent country. That's exactly what happened to Tibet, except it happened 60 years ago and, it's still under Chinese control and Chinese oppression. I would also like to say to our Indian, viewers and friends, not to forget that India and China never had a border throughout their long histories.
Mm.
You know, it was only after the Chinese invaded Tibet and took it over in 1959 that Chinese troops suddenly were at the border with India. I mean, it's that recent. And all this crisis that India now is facing along the border with China only happened because, Tibet was invaded and occupied. So not to forget that, to remember that Tibet is very important for the security and long-term kind of safety of India itself, And so just to remember that, I think, is really important.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you so much, Denzila, for being here. It is quite possible that I may have missed mentioning some of your works, given that we'll need another episode for it because your body of work is so vast. I thank you from the bottom of my heart, right from the pinnacles of my heart, for what you do for our people and for our country. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rilna. It was wonderful being able to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
If you like this episode, then please give me a shout out by mentioning me in your Instagram stories and posts. My Instagram handle is tenzin.chidun.24. That is tenzin.chodun.24. You can also DM me if you have any questions. To stay updated about waking up closer to Tibet, don't forget to follow at HD Smartcast on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. To listen to more podcasts, log on to hdsmartcast.com or suno naye nazariye se.
This was an HD Smartcast original.
HD Smartcast.